Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa.
Homage to the Blessed, Noble, and Perfectly Enlightened One.
Buddhang saranang gacchami. To the Buddha I go for refuge. Dhammang saranang gacchami. To the Dhamma I go for refuge. Sanghang saranang gacchami. To the Sangha I go for refuge. Wonderful to see you this evening. Welcome. How are you? You look great. These smiling faces. It's a great honor to be here and a delight for me to have this opportunity to share with you my knowledge, my experience with you, and to see so many of you here this evening. There's a few of you I know, but there's many, most of you I don't know. And so I don't think I'm a particular known entity. You may have heard of me, but maybe not, which isn't really important, but that you're willing to come here this evening and give your time, your energy in what I know is a busy life, because I've been a lay person now in the world for 20 years and know that life is busy and there are many distractions and there's many things to take us away from this. So I congratulate you. I honor you for that effort to be here and take this time. This evening I've chosen in these Wednesday evening talks that are given, one is given an opportunity to give a title, or I see these days people are just saying Dharma talk, so you just come for a Dharma talk or you give a particular theme. So the theme that I chose this evening is kind of twofold. It's faith in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then what do I believe? When I first wrote it, I said, what do you believe? And I says, no, I want to ask what I believe. And so speaking from my perspective of what I believe, but also inviting you, encouraging you this evening as I speak to reflect within the context of this evening and in what it is that you do believe, what you have faith in your lives, in your spiritual life, in your everyday life, in your love life, whatever it happens to be, because I think these are very essential elements to our humanity, to what makes us human is that ability to believe and to have faith in something. So in the context of that, of this evening, I'd like to kind of just, like this room kind of contains this all, so we're together in this room, and I'd like to give a few, I guess, kind of parameters of how I speak. As you notice, there's no notes up here. I forgot my notes. I'm not sure what I'm going to say, so you have to forgive me. No, not really. I was very fortunate to live with the Venerable Ajahn Chah for many years, and what he taught was to really, when one is invited in a situation like this, to get up in front of a group of people or even one person, and doesn't matter the number, really, it could be 10, 100, or 1,000, but to go inward and to speak from one's heart as best as can. And if one knows, to say, I know, and if one doesn't know, say that I don't know, and having the humility to do that, and the trust that the appropriate things will come out in a given situation. So this is as much your talk as mine, because as you sit here and give your attention, that you are participating in that way and helping to inform. So if I see any of you go to sleep, then I'll know that, you know, I'm not giving such a good talk. I maybe need to kind of jazz it up a little bit, or that if I see you're paying attention, that's an indication. But in all seriousness, if I can open my heart in the moment to be present, then I have a natural recording device. And in that natural recorder, I don't have to think about what the recorder is recording. I can just let it be recorded and I can play it back. And so I believe that, as we said, if we can kind of just open our hearts, suspend any kind of judgment and expectations of what this might be, and to just open our hearts and listen, then I believe that when we leave, there'll be things that will come back that are meant to come back, and if they don't, then they're probably not meant to come back. When I speak about the Buddha or Dhamma or Sangha, especially Buddha, I think it's very important to establish that I didn't live with the Buddha. I didn't meet the Buddha. I didn't live during that time. If I did, I don't recall that past life, not in this present moment. So that if I quote or talk about what the Buddha said, I say it in the context of kind of what I've heard. Those of you that have read scriptural sources, the Buddhist scriptures usually start with, "Thus have I heard." And I think it's a wonderful kind of theme in Buddhism, so that this was heard. It doesn't say, and then, you know, the Blessed One spoke and those were there, listened. But all the suttas usually begin with, "Thus have I heard." So this is like an oral tradition that was handed down. So my "thus have I heard" is what I've heard or practiced or realized, if you will, understood in my own personal practice and having lived in a Buddhist country with a very renowned and a true meditation master. So that I'm not saying I was there with the Buddha or that I actually know what the Buddha said, because I have yet to meet anybody that knows what the Buddha said, because they couldn't claim and recall that they were actually there and can quote the Buddha per se. So I think that's important in the context of Buddhist teachings, that because as you'll know, like in any teachings, like, well, the Buddha didn't say that, but the Buddha said this. Oh, did he? Oh. And, you know, the whole script, how that goes. So keep that in mind, and I say that because then I don't have to kind of clarify it when I actually say that. Faith and belief are a very compelling and interesting topic, and especially in Buddhism, because most of folks in the West have really, I would say, have come through the psychological door to Buddhism. And what I mean by that is that one is not asked from the outset that, well, if you're going to go to a meditation center like CIMC or go to retreat at IMS or any other kind of Buddhist retreat, meditation retreat, or do a mindfulness-based stress reduction class or whatever, There's really nothing that one has to kind of believe in. We don't go or start usually with a system of belief. My path was quite different in that, as a Vietnam veteran, I was searching quite deeply when I first arrived in Vietnam in 1969. And was thrown back upon myself in a way that I had never really been confronted with, and that was I was confronted with my own mortality. And with that confrontation, that internal kind of wrestling and confrontation that I had, then I really realized that I didn't have a particular system of belief. I didn't really have faith in anything. I'd been trained as a soldier and a helicopter pilot and taught how to go into combat and handle that, how to lead more men in those days than women in combat. But I hadn't really been prepped on, well, what if I get shot or shot up or shot down or any kind of shooting thing. And I realized, arriving in Vietnam, that they were shooting and the bullets were real and that people were dying. So that really kind of uprooted my belief system in my mortality. that I had any real stable ground to stand on. And so it set up for me this inner searching and inquiry to what is it I believe? What is it I really, what if I do get killed here? I mean, then what? And so in that search, I had been brought up with Christian influence, but I hadn't really been brought up a Christian per se. Didn't really go to church. My mother and father were very wonderful in kind of steering my sister and I in a moral kind of principle of right and wrong and stealing and lying and those sort of things, but not a staunch Catholic, or I wasn't Jewish, or any particular established religion. So I think I was very open. And so my first encounter with Buddhism was when I saw the image of a Buddha, not a Buddha image, but an actual image in Vietnam. And I don't know about others, but I find the actual image of the Buddha a very inspiring one, because it's a human being in kind of a place of what I would say perfection, just perfectly present. And the smile is, there's a hint of a smile in most Buddha images. And it's somewhat androgynous. There's usually a kind of, it looks male, but there's also a female quality. So to me, that's a very uplifting image. And so when I first saw this, like, well, what is that? What is that about? And so thus arises a certain faith. Out of curiosity, out of wanting to learn more, whatever one wants to call it. And so I would argue that those of us that come through, say, a psychological draw, oh, like Buddhism, that's cool, you know, you can kind of like reflect on things, you don't have to believe in anything, and, you know, you can kind of, you know, you can toss it out if you want, and you can take it if you, you know, you don't want, whatever, you kind of come to that. Now, I can take that. And so, I don't have it, but I'll do it with this. There's a wonderful illustration. I'll have a few illustrations, but this is one I like. And I kind of realized this a few years ago. So if we talk about faith, say, in Buddhism, and if we talk about faith in Christianity or any other theistic religion, and Buddhism I consider a non-theistic, not atheistic, but a non-theistic. We don't start with the God principle. But say there's two people. They come to an edge of a cliff. And behind one is the Buddha, and behind the other is Christ. So we've got Christ and Buddha, two kind of devout followers of each of those particular teachers. So Christ says, jump. And a Christian, without question, jumps. The Buddha says, jump. But he says, contemplate it first. But you still have to jump. So I ask you, what's the difference if the ultimate is the jump to go over the cliff? When I was living as a monk in England, I used to visit, when I lived up in the northeast outside of Newcastle, I used to visit these Buddhist groups in all around the north, Scotland, and then places like Doncaster and Leeds. And I remember this one woman that used to come to my and visit periodically, maybe once a month or something. And so I remember she came to the sitting in the group one evening as I was visiting. And she told this wonderful story how she kind of felt. And she had seen in the churches in England, they have these kind of alcoves that you go into, and there's kind of maybe literature there. And they're not really, most of them aren't protected from the elements, but it's kind of, it's like a porch, but it's a beautiful alcove, and then you go into the church. And she said they have a message board and things there. And so she talked about this current cartoon illustration that was on this board. And so this is what she described. She said it was, you know, this you know, like 4, 5, 6 stage, I don't know, I don't remember precisely, but here's a man on the, you know, hanging over the precipice, holding on to a branch, you know, hanging in space. And, you know, I, of course, very distraught that he could fall to his death. And so the first caption is like, is there anybody out there? Next caption, silence. Next one, is there anybody out there? And the next caption, yes. And the next one, help! Or no, he said first, who is it? He said, the Lord. And then he says, help! Then the next caption, the Lord says, let go. Then the final caption, is there anybody else out there? So he might be a believing Christian, but he doesn't have faith in Christ. And so I think it's important to can make somewhat of a distinction in what I believe or what you believe and what I have faith in. And I think that I wouldn't say they're synonymous, but they go together. So in my Buddhist practice, and for me to get out of the military and go back to Thailand was definitely an act of faith. And what I would say is that I believed, I read enough about Buddhism to believe in these teachings. There is something to these teachings. But my faith is the action which said I no longer can be a soldier because I don't agree with soldiering. I've done my soldiering. I no longer want to be a soldier. And I believe in this thing called Buddhism. And so my faith then is what compels and the impetus, if you will, that took me to get out of the army with a conscientious objector discharge, but not knowing I would get it honorable, dishonorable, anything in between. But the faith that I had that this is what I want to do. And then during that phase, the faith to say, well, if I'm going to study Buddhism, I don't really see it being taught in any street corner at that time in this country, so I need to go back to Thailand to become a monk. It just kind of made sense. You know? If you're going to study Buddhism, then you have to go to a Buddhist country. So it was a combination of the belief that I had in this, in these teachings, and then the action of faith of actually, all right, getting out of the military, going back to my home in Seattle, Washington at that time, telling my parents what I was going to do, and then actually preparing myself for about 3 months before I actually went back to Thailand to become a monk. So when one asks the question about what I believe, what do I have faith in, it's very important to look more and more deeply of what that is. Kind of like the word love, we talk about, well, we love this or we love that. I'm a vegetarian, I love vegetarian food, or I love, you know, fried eggplant, or I love fried calamari or whatever. But do we really love it? Do you believe in calamari or do you believe in eggplant? Do you have faith that somehow eggplant, calamari, or whatever is going to kind of take you to the next level on your journey? Of course not. It's kind of absurd. But that's how we talk. So I think we use, that the tendency is to use these words very lightly or without a deeper reflection. And what Buddhism encourages us to do is to continually investigate and inquire and ask at every level of our being. And the expression then of what I believe in my faith is manifests in how I behave, how I live my life, what I say, my verbal actions, what I do, my physical actions, and what I think, my mental actions. And that really encompasses the actions of a human being. We have physical, we have verbal, and we have mental. And so those three things, to simplify, that we're these kind of interactive, physical, verbal, mental kind of things that we call human, that we're constantly kind of interacting and bouncing off each other and liking and disliking, and because of what we say or what we do and what we like and what we don't like, and so on. So we constantly can be churned about in life by our perceptions, by what we like and don't like, what we have our attractions and our aversions and everything. And here comes this teaching and this teacher that said, well, that's important, but it's not that important. Why isn't it that important? And it's not important because that which has the nature of arising has the nature of ceasing. Does anybody know what that's called in Buddhism? Anicca, right? Impermanence, change, transiency. So if I say I take, when I said Buddhang Saranangacchami, I said I take refuge in the Buddha, or I go to the Buddha, there's action. That's a verb in the Pali. I'm not a Pali scholar by any means, but Buddhang is Buddha, and Saranang is refuge, the Sarana, and then Gacchami is action, going to or taking. Sometimes it's translated as I go to the Buddha for refuge, or I take refuge in the Buddha. What does that mean? Are you going to take refuge in this image up here of whatever the material that it's made of? Sure, you can, but it's just an image. So no matter if you carry it around and put it in a backpack and sleep with it and go to the toilet with it and shower with it and all the rest of it, I don't know how much good it's going to do. It might be a good reflection. What do you got in your bag? I got a Buddha. Oh, you always carry, yeah, everywhere I go, I carry my Buddha. I carry a little one here. This has special meaning, the one around my neck. But it's a reminder, it's a reflection for you and I to reflect, to remember the quality. So Buddha is what is awake, the one who knows, the one who sees very clearly. So if I take refuge in Buddha, I'm not taking refuge in a Buddha image or even in a historical Buddha. I'm taking refuge in what Buddha knows. And what Buddha knows is that that which has the nature of arising has the nature of ceasing. All of a sudden, if you're with me now, feel the ground we're on? The earth? The floor? Everything's vibrating. It's changing. It's all like an earthquake, but we just don't feel the tremor. So there's this flux, this continuous flux happening. So my faith in Buddha, if I'm expressing that faith and what I believe, if I believe in that and I express my faith, then I take less seriously things that I think are more permanent and aren't going to change. So I'm trying to take refuge in something that's permanent or have faith in something that's permanent, and I don't see. You can tell me, and please stay for question and answers, and I would love to have the discussion of what you see, hear, feel, taste, touch, or think that's permanent. Meaning it doesn't change. Meaning that it somehow is cast in stone. This is more permanent than a thought. Agreed? You know, a thought kind of comes and goes. Well, this is, it's solid. It has the whole appearance and feeling of solidity. So that's the earth element. And so the earth element is that thing which you and I, well, that doesn't change so much. But within this, if you get a physicist or something, will tell you that the molecular level, this thing's vibrating, and it's in a constant state of change. That's the first thing that I think we all can grasp when we're investigating these teachings and this Dhamma, or Dharma is more commonly known. The same word, Pali in Sanskrit, to the same word, which is the teaching, but really the truth. What the Buddha pointed to and taught was the Dhamma, which was the way that things are, how things are. So how things are right now is that everything is the rising is passing away. Now, as you're looking at me in this very moment, are you seeing the same person that you saw a few moments ago? Or is it a different person? Or is it a kind of a continuation of the person that first came in? That investigative quality is highly encouraged, and I encourage it. And I believe that probably many of you here find that attractive, because through investigation, then we begin to understand. And through our understanding, then we deepen our practice. And by deepening our practice, that we are freed little by little from that which binds us to the second thing that the Buddha talked about. So the first is all that which has the nature of arising has the nature of ceasing. And everything else is based on that, these three characteristics of all conditioned existence. Conditioned is a very important word to keep in mind. So that which is conditioned, and the challenge for each of us is to, like, what is not conditioned? Thoughts are conditioned. What we see, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch, and what we think are all conditions. All conditioned things have the nature of arising and have the nature of ceasing. They have a beginning and they have an end. So there's this flow, just like our breath. Think of our breath. What a lovely thing. The breath is always present. That I encouraged at the beginning, those of you who are here for the sit, to just be with the body and the breath. It's that simple. Now, body and breath. Relax, it'll be okay. Just body. But the mind, I want to know you. Constantly jumping, wanting to know more, have more, do more, whatever. Did you have a good sit? Oh, I had a wonderful sit. Good. I'm very happy for you. Did you have a wonderful sit, Joseph? It was all right. You know, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being with you. It was a good sit. You know, but it wasn't really particularly good or bad. I was restless. I was thinking about what I was going to say. I was very nervous, you know, or whatever. With change, with that arising and passing away, the second is that all conditioned things are dukkha. And I think it's important, like we have dharma, we have karma, we have nirvana, all these Pali Sanskrit words that are really are part of our English language now for many people. Not everybody, but karma, certainly everybody, hardly anybody, you know, they have some weird ideas about karma. Like, it's my karma. I got really bad karma, you know. And I think it's my karma, man, you know, I'm really. Nirvana. Oh, yeah, well, there was a rock band, Nirvana, you know. So, yeah, I don't think they were probably even close to Nirvana, but. But they had a good time and, you know, got high and did whatever they did. So dukkha is another word. Dukkha means unsatisfactoriness, means pain, means suffering, means anxiety, means sorrow, lamentation, means anything that changes. Now it's sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair if you or I attach to it. So this bell has the nature of arising and ceasing, but it's my bell. It's mine. Joseph Kappel, right on the bottom there, you see it? You know? So now I'm attached to this bell. If the bell breaks or drops or something happens to it, then I suffer because I've attached to it, because it's mine. So if I just see there is the bell, and I kind of look after the bell, and I own it for all practical purposes, that it doesn't get bent or banged around, or, you know, somebody takes it and puts it on their head and acts silly with it or something. I'm kind of responsible for the bell. But the ownership is not really, and really, nobody really owns it, do they? It's just a bell that comes together. So, but when I attach to that conditioned thing and it becomes mine, I put that attachment to it, that's when it becomes dukkha. Okay, not before, but after I do. So they go together. So anicca, transiency, change, all that arises passes away, informs you and I that, okay, if I try to resist in any way change, then I usually suffer. Does anybody know about that? No. Okay. And then the third one, the big one, you know, the real cruncher, you know, that last one, you know, the three characteristics of all conditioned existence. Conditioned is so critical. So keep that in mind because it will help you, I believe, in your practice. So all conditioned existence is changing. It's dukkha, and there ain't nobody home. There is nothing in this conditioned realm that you or I can say. So I just had I whacked this finger. You see a little black mark there? So I lost part of the nail. It just kind of came off, you know. So if I was attached to that nail, which would be kind of absurd, as long as it's attached, it's mine. But when I cut it off, then it's a nail. If I find it in my soup, if I know it's mine, it's not too bad. If I think it's somebody else's in my soup, then it's pretty bad, you know? You know? That's my wife's Catherine's nail. I love her dearly, but I don't really want her nails in my soup. And so the way that we attach to, and so it's personal when it's connected, but when it's disconnected, it becomes very impersonal. So we can't say the nail is me. This is Joseph. There's Joseph 1, 2, 3, or any kind of absurd thing. And so transiency change helps us to understand that with change, and we resist it, we attach to it, that we're going to suffer accordingly. And that which suffers is just part of the conditioning. So what I believe and how I exercise my faith is to investigate those characteristics in everything that I experience. And our experience is through what our sense bases. So right now we're primarily seeing and hearing and some thinking. I've asked you to kind of suspend thinking and judgment and just kind of listen. So what we see and what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch, feel, tactile sensations, hot, cold, and so on, is all part of our conditioned existence. But there's nothing fixed in it that we can say we really can kind of cast in stone. And even if it's cast in stone, like they do with tombstones, say, isn't that interesting? Human beings put a tombstone up because that has more sense of permanency, but there's a dead body in the ground, you know, but we're going to have a tombstone so that looks permanent somehow. That kind of reassures me that, you know, maybe death is a little ways down the line or whatever. So I encourage and I invite you to reflect on, well, what is it in your day today existence, whether you consider yourself a Buddhist, a Christian, a Jew, some combination, Muslim, whatever it might be, your faith, what you believe in and what you practice, is that how does it stand up to inquiry? How does it stand up to, not only inquiry, but how does it manifest in my day-to-day life? Just like the example of going to the edge of the cliff, I think is a wonderful example, because in the end we have to jump. In Buddhism we call that letting go. And that's probably one of the most challenging things that we all have. If someone dies in our lives that we love, that is very dear to us, mother, father, a loved one, a child, whatever it might be, that it's that. Everybody can relate to that, can't they? That it hits us because we had something and now we no longer have that. We never really had it, but we thought we had it. And so it's just dharma. It's just the manifestation of whatever arises passes away. Get over it. Wow, he's not very sensitive, is he? Like, but on the other hand, having lived in Thailand, it was incredibly refreshing. because Thai people, even though they may not practice perfectly their Buddhism is much more faith-oriented. Here we're much more practice-oriented. But in their faith, they know that if we're born, we're going to get old, we're going to experience a certain amount of illness, and ultimately, we're going to kick the bucket. So, do we have a bucket list, you know, that we want to do? I think priority of our bucket list would be, well, how am I going to face my demise? Am I preparing for my demise? You know, I'm early 20s, you know, later when I get to be Joseph age, or Larry, Maddie just told me Larry is going to be 80, you know, Larry Rosenberg. You know, he's getting on, you know, and I trust that Larry's been, you know, practicing, you know, what he's going to do at his demise. He's been practicing Buddhism for a lot of years. And I lived with a teacher in Thailand for a period that encouraged death rehearsal. Now, we rehearse maybe a lot of things, but how often do we rehearse death? And we said, well, that's kind of weird. But like if you were given like a day, and there might be people here, and I know way if there is anybody that's looking at it in a more thrown in your face kind of way, you know, that I honor and encourage that before that time comes, what is our preparation for that time? What are we doing? You know? So we're very busy, all of us. And look how busy we are, and what is really important? What's the most important thing that we can be doing as humans? So for me, I want to make a difference. What does that mean? I want to be in some way of service. I want to help. I want to have a legacy that says Joseph Kappel, you know, we threw his ashes in Washington State where he grew up, and in Thailand where he spent some time, and in England where he had a good time as a monk as well. And so we'll spread him to those three places and put a fourth one in for good measure, maybe, I don't know, Massachusetts, because I've lived here for quite a while. So he's gone in four directions, you know. But that's just a memory and the ashes and so on. But it would be nice, I think, and this is certainly self-oriented, but like, oh, yeah, he was a monk, and then he was a non-monk, and he kind of like gave some good talks, and I learned something from him, and that was useful, that was helpful. I don't know, and I don't believe any of us here really know. We get it later in our lives, sometimes more sooner, sometimes later, of kind of the influence that you or I may have had on someone in something that we did. Maybe it was a really small thing, a very small thing. But saying, well, I remember that, and I've had that people in England where I lived for 7 years. It's like, oh, I remember this talk you gave, and you know, and it was like it really inspired me, you know, and I've been practicing Buddhism ever since. And wonderful. I don't remember, you know, and it's kind of hard to say, well, I don't remember, but you know how that is. It's like we don't remember and we remember less. So kind of the aging process helps us to be more Buddhist. It helps us be forgetful rather than, you know, remindful of like what we just kind of let go of. My mother just had her 85th birthday, and she's saying, oh, I don't remember. I can't remember. I says, Mom, that's great. You're practicing Buddhism perfectly. There's nothing to remember anymore. We love you, you know. And we embrace you, and we honor everything that you are. One of another illustration that I think expresses the difference, or that the connection, but also I think an illustration of faith. When I had lived in Thailand, I went there in 1971, and I was very blessed to meet a young monk who had come from the Northeast. I was in Bangkok at the time, told him about this teacher, Ajahn Chah. He's jovial, he's great, you ought to see him. Went up there, and I liked him, asked to stay, and so I stayed. And usually the first 5 years, one is encouraged in monastic life and in the tradition to stay with a teacher for 5 years, stay in one place, or wherever the teacher wants you to be or go, that you trust that. And Ajahn Chah was not a big man. You know, he was maybe 5 feet at best, and, you know, he was kind of chubby and jovial and had just this kind of warmth that exuded and love and things, and his hands were not all that big. But I remember those of us who were there in those early years, he used to say, "Ha, Pai, you know, 5 years." And he'd hold that little hand of his up and say, 5 years, you know. And I remember looking up at that hand and said, 5 years, you know. His hand's not very big, but that seems like a big request. But my belief and my faith said, that man knows what he's talking about. I trust him. I believe in that. And my faith is saying, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to endure the mosquitoes and the heat and the malaria and on and on and on and never really be acclimated because it's always hot and I'm always sweaty and, you know, I hate the humidity and the bugs and all the rest of it. But I'm going to stay. After 5 years, I was given the responsibility of being the senior monk at a monastery that Ajahn Sumedho and many of us Western monks at that time had started, very near Ajahn Chah's kind of home monastery. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I had this desire to want to go off on my own. So after 5 years, one was encouraged then to maybe go visit other teachers or do something they called pilgrimage or tudong, which means kind of wandering, so kind of stepping outside of the influence and the kind of the comfort of the nest and kind of strike out on one's own and see what happens. And so I did that. In Thailand, it's not too much of a leap of faith because everybody knows monks and everybody pretty much respects monks and they always want to feed you and take care of you and give you a ride. And so it's hard to kind of be more austere because everybody wants to give you things. You know, that's just how they are. And then they see you're a Westerner. They say, oh wow, what are you, Americans, they've got so much, all the things that we want. And they've given that all up to be, you know, here, have some more. You know, they're very generous and that's just their nature. But I had an opportunity to go off on my own. And this is what I want to share. And I was staying at this monastery. This teacher had a very remote place that I'd spent some time at out in the, in kind of rural jungle and mountains. And I wanted to kind of go off my own. I knew this particular area, this one province in Thailand, and I knew there was a lot of, kind of jungle, wild area, and maybe some caves in this particular area. So two of the monks that I knew, Thai monks that I knew, they gave me a ride to this road. And it was raining. And so I had my alms bowl, which is, it was a little smaller than this, but you know, I had a pretty big alms bowl. It wasn't quite that big. So you have your bowl, you know, a pair of sandals, a little umbrella, which you hang a mosquito net to protect you from the, from mosquitoes and malaria and stuff. And they dropped me off and it was raining. It was muddy. And there I was alone at this kind of juncture. It was a road. And significant road, and the path into that wilderness, into that unknown was there. And so it took everything, you know, in my heart to say, I need to go down this path. I need to do this. It was raining. It was muddy. So what's worse than it's you're alone, it's raining, it's muddy. Maybe you have a little water, but you don't know where your next meal is going to come from. You don't know where you're going to stay that night. So it's like taking... You know, so the mud was like each step I was trying to kind of get out of this mud. And I was reflecting on this story before the seed and I realized, well, that was both belief that this was something that I wanted to do that I would learn from. And my belief is what took me step by step down that path. Long story short, I ended up in this incredible cave with a wonderful group of people, just villagers out in the wilderness. That, you know, supported me for 4 months while I lived alone in this cave. And it was definitely faith that kept me in that cave because everything wanted to run from that cave. Being alone, I had enough to eat. The cave was very dry, relatively dry, and had lots of creepy crawlers in it, but that's just kind of part of the jungle and living in Thailand. But it was my faith that kept me there knowing that this was an experience that I would learn from and that I would benefit in some way. So I believed in that, and then my faith kept me there. And I was looking for any excuse. I said, I have to have a good reason to leave or I can't leave. I had that kind of resolution in my heart. So lo and behold, I get a letter that was taken because when you're anywhere, you need to let others know where you are, especially as a Westerner and stuff. And so I got this little letter, and it said that Ajahn Sumedho was going to be visiting from England. He was in England at the time. Oh, I got to see Ajahn Sumedho. He'll definitely want to see me. So that's all I needed to leave the cave. I don't think it was faith that took me out of the cave, actually. It's about 8:30 now. As I like to summarize, for lack of better term, that what I've encouraged this evening is for each of you in your own way, or continuing in your own way of what your belief, what your faith is. And I talked about taking refuge. And so if you or I take refuge in something, then it needs to be something that's safe, that's secure, that we feel relative security. So asking ourselves, well, what is it that I take refuge in on a daily basis? If I take refuge in the Buddha, then I'm taking refuge for me in what the Buddha taught. And basically the Buddha taught in really simplified forms that all that arises passes away, that is unsatisfactory, and there's really no personality or self to be found in that. So if I'm taking refuge in that wisdom in Buddha, then that's what I'm attempting to live and to manifest in what I say, what I do, and ultimately what I think. And as we go away in our respective lives and reflect on this, it's my hope that something that I've said this evening will be of benefit to you, will encourage you in your lives, and help lead you down your particular path that ultimately, I believe that we all want to be awake, that we want to move to the light and away from the darkness. And so all of us, each of us, every one of us needs that encouragement. So we have this wonderful center where they have ongoing great teachers come and an opportunity to come, and they have scriptural things, and they have probably every Buddhist book that's out there and then some that you can come and study. And so this is a place of refuge, just because we can come in here and know that there's not going to be usually probably anybody undesirable in here. It's going to be people that are like-minded, just like everybody sitting here. You know, none of you were antagonistic or, you know, threw anything at me while I was giving a talk. I mean, you're all quite respectful. And of course, that's what one would expect and hope. And that's a great thing. That's a wonderful thing. And if you haven't done a day retreat, then I encourage you to do a day-long retreat. And if you've done a day-long, you haven't done a weekend, I encourage you to do a weekend. And if you haven't done a 10-day, I encourage you to do a 10-day. And if you haven't done a 3-month, I encourage you to do a 3-month. And if you think about shaving your head, then I can give you some addresses and some contacts. Thailand, England, Switzerland, you know, wherever you might like to go, I can, you know, can point you in that direction as well. And so that your faith, your belief will be supported and help to be manifested, so that you may free yourself day by day from all that which, you know, hides us. So I'd like to end with wishing that all the forces of goodness and healing and well-being be present in each of our lives, that we be well and happy, free from anxiety and sorrow, and that we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. Thank you for listening and for being here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.